from Missouri to North Carolina, New York to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration's war on fossil fuels has crushed investment in oil and gas pipelines and contributed to skyrocketing gas and home heating costs. Dr. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation is here to explain. All signs are pointing to a likely recession as the economy continues to falter. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story on the political impact. The U.S. Supreme Court did curtail the power of the Environmental Protection Agency, but it isn't climate change Armageddon. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Devin Hartman of the R Street Institute. And on this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College takes a nostalgic look back at a time when gas prices were low and you even got your oil checked and windshield washed. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Biden likes to blame everyone from greedy corporations to Russian President Vladimir Putin for record-high gas prices. But the fault really lies with his own policies. Dr. Merrill Matthews is a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation. He is here to explain. Merrill, welcome to American Radio Journal. Merrill, in your policy brief, you stated that while President Joe Biden and the White House are pointing fingers at everyone else for the current energy crisis, and indeed they are doing that, Biden deserves most of the blame for this. How so?
Several things that he's done during his administration, which has sent signals to the industry. And on his very first day in office, he canceled the Keystone XL pipeline. That was a project. The Keystone XL pipeline was only phase four of a broader, what was called the Keystone Pipeline Project. And ironically, it's been up and running for years, carrying crude oil from Alberta, Canada, down through the United States to the Gulf of Mexico for refining. The Keystone XL was just simply going to be another branch of that to increase capacity of crude oil coming in the U.S. by about 800,000 barrels a day, and he canceled that. Ironically, he's been negotiating apparently with Venezuela to get Venezuela from there. They used to actually get us about 700,000 or 800,000 barrels a day. We stopped that, but if he hadn't canceled the Keystone XL, he might not have had to worry about going to Venezuela.
In terms of these pipelines, not only has the Keystone XL pipeline been canceled, Doctor, but in addition to that, what's happening with the capital investment in new pipelines in other parts of the country? Has it slowed down as well?
It has, yes. We've got millions of miles of pipeline in the country that's carrying natural gas, it's carrying crude oil, petroleum products, and so forth throughout the country. That's the best, most efficient, and safest way to get these products from one place to another. But what we had during the, over the past, 12, 13 years, we had an increase in pipeline development, especially after the fracking, movement that started in the mid-2000s. And we needed that pipeline increase because we were creating so much more oil and natural gas. That went up to about 2014. We had 35 new pipelines completed in 2014. That sort of went up and down a little bit for the next several years. It went up every year under President Trump, but under President Biden, it has gone down in 2021 and 2022. And in fact, so far, we're halfway through the year. We have completed two new pipelines this year. Now, 2014, we completed 35 pipelines in all. In 2019, we completed 30 pipelines. We have completed two so far this year. And if we don't have a way to move that material from where it's being produced to the refineries, we're going to have some huge shortages. And that's part of the problem that we're facing right now.
President Biden, of course, is jawboning the oil and gas companies, saying, I want you to ramp up production. This despite, as you've just pointed out, canceling pipelines and not allowing new pipelines to be built. Doesn't even discuss the issue of oil leases and such that have been canceled. But the president is wanting the oil and gas companies to ramp up production. Given the fact that they're making profits off of this, why are they slow to want to take up that offer?
It's a very good question, and there's several reasons for it. But one of the primary reasons is that for several years now, the progressives, the left, have been putting pressure on various types of investments, investors, banks, hedge funds, and so forth, pressuring them not to invest in the oil and gas industry, in the fossil fuel industry. They've threatened to boycott them, protest, and do other things, and the investors got that message. They heard that message, and so as a result, many of the companies, especially the medium and smaller size companies that have been trying to find investments to in order to be able to ramp up production, simply can't find those investments. The second thing is the oil and gas industry knows good and well that once we get past this crisis, or once we get past November elections, the progressives are going to make the oil and gas industry the pariah again, and they know that's going to happen, so they've just not been interested in trying to bail out the Biden administration, given all of the criticism they get from progressives.
Has the federal government also taken steps, or are they considering taking steps, to clamp down on investment in the oil and gas industry?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's been legislation proposed to force the Federal Reserve Bank to try to look at various types of possible investments out there to make sure that they are sort of clean energy related, not increasing carbon emissions and that type of thing. There have been various banking groups that have taken pledges. Blackstone is one of the major investors out there, and they had pulled back from that, stressing their emphasis on green and renewable energy. So yes, it's the administration has been pushing that. There's been legislation proposed, not passed, and there was even with one of the new Fed, with one of the new people who would be working at the Fed, that person had to pull their name from nomination, but who was supposed to be looking at this to make sure that any investments going on out there were sort of compatible with the green energy goals of the Biden administration. And if you're a wildcat, or if you're an oil and gas company, are you going to try to go and build some of these new production facilities, pipelines, pump out more when you know that you're liable to get in trouble if you do from the administration?
Looking ahead then, Doctor, if we are wanting to see the price of gasoline come down at the pump, the cost of home heating oil, et cetera, come down, is there any hope on the horizon? Do we see any potential change in administration policy that might give us reason to think that this price increase trend could at least stabilize, if not reverse itself?
The only change we're seeing from the administration is a change from its anti-fossil fuel stance to being pro-fossil fuels, at least for the time being. But everybody knows that's a time-limited change. It's not going to be that way for long. So the real solution here is to get the government out of the business again. We were doing that over the past several years, and we saw that natural gas and gasoline, crude oil, was the U.S. had become sort of the leading producer of both of those things. We were becoming energy dominant in the world, and now we scaled back from that. A little bit of that's from the pandemic, but also from the policies of the administration. So the government's got to get out of this and let the industry work, and if we do that, we'll not only be able to meet our needs, but we'll be able to help out our allies who are getting hammered by Russia, which has always used energy as a political tool.
We have been talking with Dr. Merrill Matthews, who is a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation. Doctor, tell us a bit about the Institute.
We were started in 1987. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We work on a range of different policy issues, including health policy, tax policy, energy, and also technology.
And where can folks go to find you on the web?
It's easy to find us, ipi.org.
Dr. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation. Doctor, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It is midsummer in the nation's capital, and that means things are a little slower than usual, but we do have fears relative to the U.S. economy that are percolating around the country. We're going to talk about that with Scott Parkinson. Scott is from the Club for Growth, and he joins us now. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
We have a situation, Scott, where inflation has been running at 8.5, 8.6%. The stock markets are off by over 20%. There are economists starting to use the R word, recession. Are those fears well-founded?
Well, I think they are. The Club for Growth Foundation, which is our sister organization, nonprofit, put out a report earlier this year, authored by Diana Furchgott Roth. And Club for Girls president David McIntosh used that data and began to predict a looming recession. And even though we're not officially in that recession with two consecutive quarters of negative growth, I think that everybody's understanding right now that we're in the middle of this thing. We all saw the increased prices related to providing food and fireworks and fun on the 4th of July, Independence Day. And now we're starting to hear more talk from people outside of groups like the Club for Growth, but more in the mainstream from Washington to Wall Street, talking about the potential of a recession. We know that the Biden administration has been terrified for several months about the increases in gas prices and what that does to consumer goods that are being transported across America. So we know right now that Biden is trying to do everything he can without really upsetting the apple cart from the radical environmentalists that are in his progressive base to try to bring down prices. But just like Barack Obama, his recipe for doing that is to attack small business owners and the folks that are among the supply chain rather than to address the actual production and supply issues that are decreasing through his regulatory policies and from canceling oil leases and really going after oil and natural gas throughout America.
Looking at this going forward, Scott, we have elections coming up here, midterm elections in November. And James Carville, who was the campaign manager for Bill Clinton back in the day, famously said that it's all about the economy, stupid. And those are his words, not mine.
Yeah, I remember that.
But is it still all about the economy? And what impact is this going to have for what appears to be a building red wave this November?
Yeah, well, I think a red wave is certainly starting to accumulate quite a bit of force. We feel really good about winning back the House of Representatives. And the United States is obviously a 50-50 split right now with a lot of really difficult competitive races coming up. The economy is definitely going to be one of the top issues in November because we know it's not going to improve enough over the next 4 months to go off of people's radar. When you think about those kitchen table conversations, folks are making real difficult decisions in relation to how they spend their money. But you've got Joe Biden over here wanting to take even more of our money. This week, he called to roll back the Trump tax cuts in their entirety. He said that he also wanted to ensure that we're going after corporations and that we roll back the Trump tax cuts. Well, you know, those tax cuts were $1.5 trillion tax relief for the American people, and they helped breed that economic boom alongside regulatory reform during the Trump administration in 2017 and 2018. Really in the year ahead of hitting the coronavirus pandemic. So I'm really worried about what the future of the economy holds. I do think that we're headed for a recession. Does that mean that we're headed for stagflation or some sort of a long-term depression? I really hope not. But right now, the policies that we've got from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue are not giving me any confidence that we're going to turn this thing around at least before November when folks hit the ballot booth.
When you use the term recession, Scott, that's an economic term. Everybody knows it's bad. Not everybody knows exactly what it means. The last time we had one was the Great Recession of about 13, 14 years ago. When we go into a recession, what impact does it have on those people, as you mentioned, who are sitting around the kitchen table? Does a recession really affect them?
Well, it does. Recessions obviously result in business decisions for investment. It results in pretty significant layoffs. It can result in financial crisis. It can result in prices increasing that we're already seeing. That's why I feel like many people understand that we're in that recession already. It can result in stock prices and investment, things that people have been saving up for a generation to completely be wiped away. And so what can we do to really address these things right now? We obviously want to return to a pro-growth agenda that incentivizes the sort of investment and job formation that those that are willing to do business risk will see certainty and begin to make those investments. We need a very clear regulatory policy that does not stifle innovation. We need to decrease taxation and stop threatening tax increases that get investors nervous. A lot of people like to attack these multinational corporations, but the reality is multinational corporations are a significant indicator for economic activity in America. And when we're thinking about investment and reinvestment, the jobs that that comes along with, the productivity, and all that leads to good macroeconomic effects, including wage increases. Think about how stagnant wages have been over the last 2 years, and they've been completely wiped out by this, you know, 8.6% inflation. I think that inflation right now is not going anywhere, and that's the underlying theme of this problem of the looming recession. Biden has caused the inflation through his reckless policies. He doesn't know how to address it, and the bottom line is people are feeling that pain right now. When you go to buy a pound of hamburger, when you go to buy chicken, when you go to buy bacon, when you go to buy darn near anything, those prices are way up from where they were just a few years ago. And the result is a weakening dollar, too. So let's see what happens. We need to figure out a smart energy policy that does get back to domestic production and doesn't rely on tyrants from Venezuela and Russia and elsewhere and Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. So we do want to see strong energy policies emerge from this White House, but I don't have any confidence that's going to happen until Biden begins to turn the other cheek to the progressives that are currently running the West Wing.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Sure thing. Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Club for Growth PAC is our political entity. If anybody wants to check out the candidates that we've endorsed, the races that we're involved in, or the policies that our 525,000 members agree upon, check us out at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
All right, thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled the Environmental Protection Agency cannot issue sweeping regulations that fundamentally change the economy, but they still have other tools in their toolbox. Eric Boehm gets details from Devin Hartman of the R Street Institute.
In the wake of last week's ruling from the Supreme Court on abortion, there was actually another decision that I think, if anything, got even more misleading media coverage. I'm talking, of course, about the EPA v. West Virginia case. In fact, I think the worst example of media coverage of this that I saw was a tweet from one Mr. Paul Krugman. You've probably heard of him. And he tweeted on June 30th, "Kneecapping environmental regulation is existential. The Supreme Court has just come down on the side of civilizational collapse." Are those really the stakes in this, what was actually a pretty mundane case regarding the limits of the regulatory state? That's what we're going to take a closer look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Devin Hartman. He is the Director of Energy and Environmental Policy at the R Street Institute, and he is here to help us set the record straight on this. Devin, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks, Eric. I'll do my best.
Mr. Krugman says that this is civilizational collapse, Devin. What did the Supreme Court actually say last week?
What the Supreme Court actually said is that EPA can actually retain its authority on regulating greenhouse gas emissions from this sector, and there's nothing to say that broader authority is even questioned here. What it does say is it's going to limit the regulatory toolbox that EPA has at its disposal. Notably, under the Clean Power Plan, under the Obama administration, they took a very creative approach called generation shifting, which basically means EPA was deciding how much coal, natural gas, or other fuels would be good for society to have in the mix going forward. And it used that to sort of use that as its interpretation of the best system of reducing emissions under the Clean Air Act. And the court basically said, nope, can't do that, but also we're not going to comment on whether you can issue regulations on a more individual or facility-specific type basis for these same emissions. So again, EPA hasn't really lost its overarching authority. It just has more limited tools moving forward. But the bigger takeaway is, frankly, this doesn't matter. This isn't going to materially affect emissions trajectories in the coming decades. And so really any alarmist take on this is really misguided.
I can imagine, and in fact, I don't have to imagine because I heard this and read this from some of my liberal friends last week in the wake of this ruling, but you can imagine that the Clean Air Act is something that Congress passed that was kind of at the crux of this case. And the most simplistic take is, hey, Congress gave the EPA the authority to regulate our air, to make sure that the air is clean. Isn't that good enough? Why is that not good enough in terms of the sort of the legal doctrines here, or the legal underpinning of what the EPA was trying to do in West Virginia?
The big question here is that the Clean Air Act, right, it's a half century old statute. They were really focused on what we call more conventional criteria pollutants and toxics. That's really what the Clean Air Act is designed to address. And these are either regional or more localized pollutants that directly affect human health and welfare. And so that's typically what the regulatory tools under the Clean Air Act are meant for. And then there was a bit broader interpretation by EPA, which the Supreme Court supported, that they expanded that focus into greenhouse gases, which are really global emissions mix that ultimately determines how much the climate is warming going forward. So the Clean Air Act really isn't even the best statute to examine how to address those things. And really what Congress made clear, and I thought the Chief Justice made this pretty clear in his decision and rationale, was that this is, you know, regardless of the importance of the issue, it comes down to what authority Congress granted the agency. And if the matter is of that importance, of that level of importance, it really puts the onus back on Congress to address the issue the right way, rather than exploring an expansive creep of the executive.
That's an important distinction, and one that I didn't really see a lot of in the analysis of this decision last week, the difference between like toxic pollutants in the air and greenhouse gases in the air, which can, you know, contribute to global warming, and ultimately there are consequences there, but obviously the direct connection to like harmful air is a little bit different, and I think that's pretty important. We're talking with Devin Hartman. He's the Director of Energy and Environmental Policy at the R Street Institute. He's written a piece that you can find at rstreet.org this week about this Supreme Court decision in EPA v. West Virginia. Devin, just about a minute left here. Wrap up for me real quick. But what is the way forward here for Congress, for policymakers in general, as they do try to address climate change? What does this decision mean for that?
So I think we need to just take stock of what actually drives emissions reductions, both in the power industry, which is what this specific ruling dealt with, and the broader economy. What we're broadly seeing is that private capital is incredibly motivated now to drive deep emissions cuts. And we're really seeing that just build up more and more. It's not actually, there's not really that much weight on the role of government to force private capital to shift. The investment theses are already there to drive this deployment. And what we actually see is that the biggest barriers to emissions cuts in this industry are barriers to developing clean infrastructure. Right now, you already have more wind and solar trying to come online than you have in the entire existing fossil fleet. So there's a ton of motivation already there, and we really need to be focused on reducing the regulatory barriers to cleaner energy going forward so that private capital can flow. That is what's going to ultimately drive emissions cuts. And it's also just good economic policy. So it's really a win-win.
Get government out of the way. That's what I like to hear about everything. Devin, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, Eric.
And again, that is Devin Hartman. He is the Policy Director for Energy and Environmental Issues at the R Street Institute. Check out his latest work at rstreet.org. EPA decision has major legal ramifications, but minor climate impact. It's a good read. You could check out more of our coverage of that decision, of everything else that's come out of the Supreme Court as well, at reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
There was a time when gas prices were low and your car even got serviced when you filled up your tank. Minimum wage laws and government interference in the energy markets have changed all of that. As Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
My father-in-law, his name is Al, recently handed me something he came across in a box of old stuff. It was a receipt from a gas station, namely Wilson's Pleasant Valley Station in McMurray, Pennsylvania, date June 13, 1958. The receipt was signed by Al, who then was a hustling teenage boy working at the gas station. What immediately struck Al and me and you too was the cost of gasoline. Currently, you're paying at least $5 per gallon. In Al's day, it was 33.3 cents per gallon. The handwritten receipt for Al's customer listed a dollar for gas altogether, 6 quarts of motor oil for $3.60, a lube for $1.50, an oil change, a new filter for $3.15. The grand total, $9.46, which today, ladies and gentlemen, wouldn't get you even 2 gallons of gas at a Sheetz. Also, the total included merely 21 cents in sales tax, which means that the sales tax was half the percentage that it is today. Now, all of this, of course, is very revealing. It will make you chuckle or maybe scream. But let's take a deeper dive. Al's receipt is revealing of a lot more. First off, inflation in 1958 was 2.8%. Today, 8.6%. Purchasing power for your hard-earned cash was much better. Second, the price of gasoline was so much lower because we were drilling domestically. This was long before we started depending on the Middle East or countries like Venezuela for oil. We were getting oil not only from domestic states like Texas, but from Al's home state of Pennsylvania, the state of Quaker State, Pennzoil, Oil City, Titusville, where the oil rush began. Most important, we didn't have a president and an entire political party declaring war on fossil fuels, blocking drilling and trying to force an entire population to electric cars and public transportation. Republican President Dwight Eisenhower would have dubbed the Green New Deal a form of insanity. So would the Democrats of his day. The Democrats back then were the party of the working man. Not only was gas far more affordable in 1958, Al told me that he bought his car for $100. It was used, but still, that was a good deal. The price of used and new cars right now is awful. Car prices have been uniquely terrible. Finally, consider this. Unemployment right now is likewise terrible. Our unemployment rate does not capture the extraordinary number of unfilled jobs. The number of non-working people in America right now is shocking. Finally, one more thing. Al worked as a teenage boy at that gas station for a rate of under a dollar an hour. The gas station could afford to pay Al that small amount because there was no state minimum wage law yet. Liberals, of course, are fanatical about minimum wage laws. They're constantly battling to raise the minimum wage. But as any rational economist will tell you, hiking the minimum wage costs businesses money, to the point where they can't hire a teenager for a few bucks per hour, even if the teen is willing to work for that amount. In fact, one of the reasons you no longer see young boys filling you up at a gas station and running around cleaning your windows, checking your tires, and checking your oil is because minimum wage laws killed those jobs. There are plenty of young boys today who would do that job for a few bucks an hour, half of the current minimum wage. My 14-year-old son would. He tells me, "Dad, that job would be awesome." The typical liberal Democrat would howl in protest, "You can't raise a family on $5 an hour." But of course, that's not the kind of job for someone raising a family. It's a job for a teen boy, not a 40-year-old father of three. In all, Al's receipt from June 1958 adds up to a more affordable time and also a more sane time. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KFMR-FM in Jackson, Wyoming. Welcome to our new listeners in the Cowboy State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the cost of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.